This week's lesson is a continuance of chapter 13. And the next lesson you're going to get is going to be on Daniel chapter 11. That'll be a month from now. I haven't got that done yet. But this lesson here is going to continue on, and it's going to show us the second beast in Revelation 13. The first few slides here are a review from last time. So let's go on with that. What we're finding out here is extremely important. We are facing the final events that are portrayed here in Revelation 13. We're looking at it. Very shortly, it will come to pass. I'm not time setting. I don't believe in time setting, but very shortly, these things will come to pass. Do we truly know who we're worshiping? And more than that, do we know why we worship him? This is going to be the deciding question. This quote, I had it last time, we build temples and churches, but we do not worship in them. We hire spiritual advisors, but we refuse to heed them. We buy Bibles, but we will not read them. Believing in God, we do not fear him. And fear here, I'm sure he did not mean that we tremble in our boots over him. We do not worship him for who he is, creator of all things. We have nothing, are nothing. He is everything and has everything. And we need to comprehend that. So the last question in the final days will be, who is the one true God? Do we know? Can we tell other people who he is? Can we describe his character? Can we explain to people that he has a plan for his creatures and what that plan includes? This is a question. There are many religions out there, all kinds, pagan religions, other Christian religions, Jewish religions, Muslim religions, all kinds of religions. I mean, even within the Muslim faith, there are factions, just like within the Christian faith. There's not just Muslim religion. There's different kinds of Muslim religions. We have to know how to distinguish who the true God is, or we're not going to be able to get through that in time. Now, we studied last time about 666. Scripture says, here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. We learned last time that this was a symbol of paganism, that the number represents paganism throughout millennia. Revelation 15:2 says, and I saw, as it were, the sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his name, over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. Name in the scripture is symbolic of character. We looked at this too. Jacob got his name changed when he had his character changed. Remember, he went from Jacob to being Israel. Abraham had his name changed from Abram to Abraham. Sarah from Sarai to Sarah. You know, there were many name changes when character changed. So a name represents character. So here we can look at this and we can say we got victory over the number of his character. And if the 666 represents paganism, then we can get victory over paganism. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that received it. So we are to have a new name. We are to have a new character. Whatever our character currently is can be changed into something that God wants it to be. No matter how wicked you are, you can have your character changed. We also looked at some of the emblems in which the 666 was portrayed commonly among even things that we call a Christian. I won't go through these amulets again, but you know, we saw how these symbols and everything were counterfeits to Christ. We saw how the 666 notion and the sacred square was even brought into the Christian religion and the Catholic Church. This is the St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. At length, Imperial Rome bequeathed its power, his seat and great authority to the Church of Rome. World paganism was baptized, and with little more than a change of name, was adopted and incorporated into the papal system. And to this princely church, scripture prophecy bids us to look to find written upon her the name and superscription of paganism, 666. And we looked how this was done, that the tiara had 666 on it, that they claim you know, this 666. They're not ashamed of it. We saw and covered again, this is all a review from last lesson and many other lessons. When did the papacy become established? Got the date? 538. Thank you very much. And when did it end? 1798, when the 1260 years were over. What we are looking at here in Revelation 13 is the healing of that deadly wound that was struck in 1798. It will be healed. When it is fully healed, the end will come very soon after that. Now let's look at this second beast that's in here. The beast from the earth is what we're going to be studying this morning. And I held another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So the deadly wound has been inflicted. It is not yet healed. Some say, oh, well, it was healed over there when Mussolini gave them the territory and they moved into the Vatican. No, in 1929. No, that wasn't when it was healed. It has not yet been healed. This beast, second beast, comes up from the earth. Has two horns like a lamb. Speaks as a dragon. Exercises all the power of the first beast, which we have identified as papal Rome, without question. Causes all the world to worship the first beast, which is papal Rome. So what we need to discover here is what the symbol earth means. That'll help us identify who this beast is. We need to know how this second beast speaks like a dragon and how it can cause all the world to wander after the first beast. These are significant points of this prophecy. We need to figure this out because when this prophecy finally comes to fulfillment, all the world itself will be subject to that first beast power, except a small minority of people who will refuse to accept this. They'll say, no, we know who that true God is. We're not following any of this. We won't do it. Most of the books that you go, if you go to a bookstore, Christian bookstore or otherwise, and go to a section on Bible prophecy, the majority of the books that are sitting on that shelf are preaching futurism, which we have discovered takes the truth of the prophecy of this papacy and throws it off in the future somewhere. It twists it so that it no longer points to the papacy. It points to an antichrist of unknown origin. We learned in very early lessons of this series that we started so long ago, we learned that futurism has taken Daniel 9, verse 27, and where the he is definitely pointing to Christ and the work of Christ during 3.5 years of his ministry on earth, they take that he and they make it the work of Satan and they throw it off. No telling where in the future. We also learned in our studies at that time that this notion, this prophetic interpretation, came from a Jesuit priest, Francisco Ribera. It was specifically dreamed up in order to counter the Reformation work, the Protestant Reformation work. Well, the devil has done a very good job with this prophecy. For nearly 450 years, he's managed to keep it alive through various means. And it currently is alive through the Scofield Bible and the Moody Bible Institute and Dallas Theological Seminary. Time here appears within the time frame. The time that's being spoken of here in this prophecy, this beast coming up out of the earth, appears within the time frame of 1798 because that was the inflicting of the deadly wound. So this is the time of the end that's spoken of in Daniel 12:4. It comes up out of the earth because, in contrast to rising up out of the sea or coming up out of the bottomless pit, which are given as the sources for these other beast power. The Bible defines the sea as waters. You find that water symbol in Revelation 17:15, because waters, it says, where the whore sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. In other words, the Bible prophecy, waters and seas, symbolize a densely populated area of the world. So in contrast to that, the earth would have to be a less densely populated place of the earth. Well, this is exactly what history proves to us. The first beast came up in Europe, right? The second beast we will find comes up in a less populated area. The character is lamb-like. It's separate from the first beast. And later it speaks like the dragon. Who's the dragon? The dragon, Satan. The dragon works through papal Rome, but the dragon is Satan. The power that it possesses is a super world power unlike anything that has ever existed before it. This power is wielded in conjunction with the healing of the deadly wound that the first beast suffered. Is there a power that meets all this criteria? Absolutely, yes, there is. There has been only one world power that meets these criteria. Came into being in a territory of sparse population, rose in power in the era of 1798, not in the year of 1798, but in the era of 1798, and an era, when you use the word era, it gives you, you know, 10 or 20 years both directions. America is the only nation that has done this, the only nation in the world that has done this. When America was founded, it was this country, this nation, this territory was sparsely populated by Native Americans. America rose from the mid-1600s to become established by 1776 when we made our Declaration of Independence against the British powers. The Constitution of this United States was written in 1787. This is all within the context of 1798, right? The French Revolution began in 1789, which resulted in the Pope being taken captive in 1798. So we're all in this time frame. America, the prophecy says, will become a super world power and has remained so. Is that not true? Politically, the United States is different from every other nation on earth that ever appeared on earth. Is that not true? And for one reason, because we have a constitution that separates church and state. Religiously, it was originally different from the papacy, right? The early settlers who came here came to get away from the papacy and the persecution that the papacy was giving them in European countries. That was the reason for coming here. The second beast is also called a false prophet in Revelation 19:20. Several identification marks help us to decide this two-horned beast must symbolize the democratic Protestantism of the Occidental world, most typically seen in the United States. And Occidental means Western. You've got Occidental and Orient, okay? So Occidental means Western. So that would include Europe and the United States and whatever. And Orient is anything Middle East and over to China, okay? The Reformation was preceded by the discovery of America, as if the Almighty graciously meant to open a sanctuary to the persecuted. Is this not exactly what happened? This country was initially settled. The settlements that were first done in Virginia, as you all know the history, were done as proprietary settlements, which means they saw that there was money to be made over here. So they sent settlers over here in order to grow tobacco. Those settlements failed. The settlement that came next came into Massachusetts, and they were not proprietary. They were founded on religious principles. I mean, the people who came because they wanted to get away from the persecution they were receiving in England and in Europe. All right? The prophet, that is the prophet John, saw it in a vision, the lamb-like features, two horns that stand well for the beneficent principles of religious and civil liberty. A horn is sometimes used to denote a nation as a whole, as the four horns of the goat and the little horn in Daniel 8. You remember that? And the 10 horns of the fourth beast in Daniel 7, and sometimes some particular feature of the government as the first horn of the goat, which denoted not the nation as a whole, but its civil power. Remember you had the goat and it had two horns and one horn got bigger than the other? Okay, well, the big horn represented Alexander the Great, and then that horn was broken off, and four horns came up in its place that represented his four generals. So a horn can denote a power in general, but also can represent individuals. The remarks I have made will suffice to display the character of the Anglo-American civilization in its true light. It is the result of two distinct elements, which in other places have been in frequent hostility, but which in America have been admirably incorporated and combined with one another. I allude to the spirit of religion and to the spirit of liberty. This is Alexis de Tocqueville. He came over here. Alexis de Tocqueville was a historian, political commentator. And he came here because he just wanted to see what America was all about. And as he walked around and studied the people and studied the way we did our government, he was amazed by what he found here, that you could have this much peace and freedom, because he came from France, which was still under revolution. Franklin was probably dead by 1835, but yeah. Anyway, so, I mean, de Coqueville went back, and I mean, he was just amazed, and he went back and wrote his book, you know, Democracy in America, and his book became the foundation principle of political science today. We didn't have the notion of political science until he came along and wrote his book on the United States. The object of those who first sought these shores was to found what the world had not seen for ages, that is, a church without a pope and a state without a king. It had never been around. Expressed in other words, this would be a government in which the church would be free from civil power, and civil and religious liberty would reign supreme. Note that the church would be free from civil power. This had not been the case for how long? 1260 years. Go back beyond that. It still had, you know, one way or another, had been under the control. Either the church controlled the state or the state controlled the church. Either way, it was a bad deal. The interpretation of the two horns like a lamb referred to the principles of civil and religious liberty. Republicanism and Protestantism are also given as an equivalent expression. So it doesn't matter what terms you use, they mean the same thing, okay? The dictionary definition of a horn, as used in the Bible, is that it is a symbol of strength, pride, and glory. It is highly appropriate that freedom of thought and of conscience, the liberty to order our lives as we like, should be chosen by divine inspiration to characterize the giant power rising out of the earth in the West, just as the leopard beast. And what's the leopard beast? Of Revelation 13? Satan. What does a leopard beast represent? The leopard beast has, looks like a leopard, but he's got feet like a bear, and he has what on his head? He has horns and crowns, right? He represents this amalgamation of all the nations that have gone before him. When you read, when you put him with the previous prophecies in Daniel, it's the papacy. Okay? So this leopard beast, the dictionary definition of the horn used in the Bible is that it is a symbol of strength, pride, and glory. It is highly appropriate that freedom of thought and of conscience, the liberty to order our lives as we like, should be chosen by divine inspiration to characterize that giant power rising out of the earth in the West, just as the leopard beast was going into captivity, receiving its deadly wound at the close of the 18th century. So one's going down and the other's coming up. The leopard beast is going down in power. It lost its power to control nations while the earth was coming up. I mean, while the America was coming up. So you have these two horns, civil freedom and religious liberty. These are the backbone of this nation's power. When we lose these, we will no longer be a strong nation. In the abstract, they are good and harmless principles. But when France used these same principles in the French Revolution, they thought they were defending these same two principles, civil freedom and religious liberty. They were overthrowing both the monarchy and the papacy. But what they ended up with was tyranny, chaos. And why? Because they took God out of the equation. They thought that religious liberty meant that they didn't need a God at all. Liberty from religion. The two horns are republicanism and Protestantism. These principles in America have made America the freest nation on the earth. What God ordained for the good of mankind, moral principles, religion, worshiping of Him, God ordained these things for mankind. And when He ordained these things, they keep a nation strong. When you do away with them, the nation becomes weak. what France did when it threw out God altogether and became the first nation on the earth to be atheistic. There's been all kinds of pagan nations, but France was the first nation in the history of the world that had ever been atheistic and said there is no God. And chaos reigned. But any time a church and state are united, there will be persecution. There was persecution when they threw God out altogether, persecution in atheistic France. But any time, when you look back through history, any time that church and state have been united, there has been persecution of people who did not want to go along with that agenda. America was founded on five God-given principles: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom to assemble together without harassment, freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances. All five of these principles are in the First Amendment to the Constitution. This is not the wording of them, but this is what they mean. Freedom of religion means that nobody has to tell me when I can go to church, or even that I have to go to church. If I choose not to, I don't have to go. Freedom of speech means I can sit up here and I can tell you what I want you to hear. You don't have to listen, but I got a right to stand on the corner and say it if I feel like it. Freedom of speech means I've got a right to publish a newspaper. I've got a right to write a book. I've got a right to run a radio program. I have that right. Freedom of expression is covered there too. Our newspapers are free to print what they want to print. You can't do that in some of these other nations. You know that. Freedom to assemble together without harassment. We have a right to be here this morning, and nobody can tell us that we can't. We can also meet out on the public square if we want to. Of course, if there is a law that says that we must get a permit to assemble, we've got to cover the civil, you know, obey the civil law. But we have the right under the Constitution to assemble as long as we follow the laws of the civil government, right? Freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances. You don't get this in most countries around the world. As long as we have these principles, America will remain strong. That Constitution, which so definitely separates church and state, was the fruit of a long struggle for liberty and also an intensive study of great minds. They spent a lot of time. If you have not read anything recently about the writing of the Constitution, get you a good book and study the subject. It's fascinating. It's amazing what these men came to, how they struggled to find just the right wording to make this a free nation. And this says what? That Constitution which so definitely separates church and state. Its greatness lies in this. It protects the divine right of man against so-called right of kings and dictators. Prior to the founding of the United States, it was either the church ruled things or the king ruled things, or the dictator. And if the church was ruling things, it told everybody what it must do. If the king ruled things, there was no freedom of conscience. There was no right to decide what you were going to do. Man essentially had his free will removed until the United States came up. It is a stumbling block in the path of ambitious and designing men who would destroy true liberty. It protects the weak against the strong, the minority against the majority. It upholds the sovereignty of the individual. This Constitution gives us all those freedoms. Principally, it protects the weak against the strong and the minority against the majority. There are people who say majority rules. Well, that's true when you go vote and elect somebody into office. It is. You know, the majority is going to elect that person into office, and that's who's going to be in office, right? But the majority does not rule in matters of conscience. If I choose to think differently than anybody else on the face of this earth, and I am a majority of one, I can believe like I want to, and nobody can tell me any different. As a single individual, I have a right to dictate my conscience as I want. No, I don't have a right to get out there and get in somebody's face and try to force them against their will to believe like I do. But I have the right under that First Amendment to talk to anybody I want to about what I believe. The person doesn't have to listen. They have that right too. I have a right to publish newspapers. I have a right to run a radio program. I have a right to do whatever I want to promote my single worldview if I so choose. And everybody else has that right too. And instead of making chaos, like most people want to say, because we don't have majority rule, what do we do if we have all these individuals out there thinking whatever they want to think? What do? We have a free nation. You take that away, we no longer have a free nation. If they pass a law that majority rules, that this is going to be founded under the Baptist faith or whatever, you know, church they want to found this under, then I no longer am free, right? That's exactly right. That's what A.T. Jones said. When he faced Congress in 1888, faced that Senate hearing, they questioned him and they said, all right, what if we pass a law and we're going to do this on your seventh-day Sabbath? Would that be all right? And he said, no, sir, it would not be all right. The principle is that everybody is free. There is no law that dictates to conscience. And I held another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So this second beast speaks like the dragon, speaks like the devil. And he exercises all the power of the first beast, which is the papacy, and causes all on the earth to worship the first beast. How's he going to do this? We'll find out in a future lesson. I was going to say the next lesson, but the next lesson is going to be Daniel 11. So it won't be the next lesson. That we were going to do Daniel 11 was decided last night. So. Okay, so this beast out of the earth, this lamb-like beast, causes all the earth to worship the first beast, which results in the healing of the deadly wound suffered by the first beast. The healing of the deadly wound restores union of church and state, because that's what was taken away in 1798, right? In 1798, the papacy lost its power over the civil government of France that it had had all the way back to 508, when they baptized Clovis into the Catholic Church. All of Europe, yes, but we're talking France. When you go to the prophecy, it is France that from 508 controlled, what, you know, was subject to the control of the papacy. When Clovis was baptized in 508, then you've got 538 when the papacy has absolute dominion. For 1,260 years, it had absolute dominion, and we saw this in our previous lessons, how one king after another from the French origin fought for the papacy to maintain and its control in Europe. Okay? The healing of the deadly wound will take place when this union of church and state is reestablished, so that the papacy has control of a civil power. The deadly wound and its healing make clear that the system of anti-Christianity represented by the leopard beast was to exercise its despotic persecuting power during two distinct periods of time. The first would be long, that 1,260 years. The second will be short. Revelation 17:10 says, when he comes, he must continue a short space. These two periods of beastly dominance or persecution are separated by a period of inaction. Doesn't mean that they went completely out of business. It just means that they don't have the power that they want. This is called captivity in Revelation 13:10. The same idea of captivity is talked about of Satan when Satan is put on this earth at the beginning of the millennium and he can't do what he wants to do. He's in chains. Okay, same concept. So captivity here is that the church, the papacy, cannot do what it wants to do. These two freedoms, civil and religious, without possible contradiction, are the real cause of the deadly wound. Yes, France destroyed the concept of true civil and religious freedom because it became an atheistic nation. And it was just as persecuting against Christians as, or maybe more so, as the Catholic Church had been. You know, if you didn't go along with the French agenda, you got your head chopped off. Right? So they became a persecuting power too. But it is the civil and religious idea, the separation of civil and religious concepts, that is what took the head off the papacy, right? Caused the deadly wound. These two concepts are the continuing cause of it still remaining unhealed. As long as we have the principles of the First Amendment and the Constitution in effect, America will remain free. Because under the Constitution, we absolutely have separation of church and state. The state governs within its appointed sphere. It has a place and a work to do. The church rules in a spiritual realm, and it has no business over there in the government. Neither government nor church are to interfere with each other. Neither are to seek to control one another. We do not live under a theocracy. These people who want to take America back to one nation under God, we don't have a theocracy. We cannot be like the nation of Israel in the Bible. We cannot. So long as we maintain this Protestant and Republican form of government, then we shall remain free, and the deadly wound will not and cannot be healed. But you remove those two principles, the deadly wound will be healed. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution begins, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Roger Williams. Anybody know who Roger Williams was? Founded Rhode Island, yes, sir. Why did he found Rhode Island? He was perfectly happy in Massachusetts.
He wanted a separate state.
He didn't want a separate state. He was preaching freedom of religion. And the people that founded Massachusetts weren't going to put up with that. It's interesting to note that those who came over here to escape persecution were persecutors when they got to this country. They said, everybody's going to believe just like we believe, or you can't live in this colony. Well, Roger Williams had a little different notion. He was a Baptist, and he said no. He felt that freedom of conscience was supreme, and that nobody was going to dictate to him about what he was going to believe. And he was tried and cast out. The general court convicted him of sedition and heresy because he thought that his mind was free, and nobody could tell him how he was going to worship. Sedition and heresy were the charges brought against him, and they cast him out. And he founded the little tiny state of Rhode Island. As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded upon the Christian religion. That's an interesting statement, huh? Because everybody today says, oh no, America is one nation under God. It was founded as a Christian nation. I don't know how many times I hear that. Every week I hear it. Is it true?
No.
Do we have moral principles that uphold our civil government? Yes, we do. Where did those moral principles come from? From the Bible, of course. But it was not founded as a Christian nation. Just because we have moral principles upon which this government stands does not mean that it's a Christian nation. We are a pluralistic nation. We welcome people of all faiths. John Adams, we know who John Adams was? He signed the Declaration of Independence. He did not sign the Constitution. Why did he not sign the Constitution? Did he not like the Constitution?
It didn't have the Bill of Rights on it at the time.
He was in England.
Was
trick question.
But there were some of them that didn't sign it because of it.
Yes, and they later added, yeah.
Bill of Rights initially.
Right. But John Adams didn't sign it because he was in England as an ambassador to England. John Adams helped draft the Declaration of Independence. This was 1797 that this statement was made, and it is part of a treaty that we made with Tripoli. The Senate ratified it, and this is Article 11 from that treaty that begins, I didn't put the whole thing here because it was irrelevant. But as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. This is in that treaty. You can find it anywhere you want to. It's in books, textbooks, on the internet. The Senate ratified this treaty on June 7, 1797. That's pretty close to the founding of this nation, right? President Adams signed it on June 10, 1797, and it was first published in the session of laws of the Fifth Congress, the first session in 1797. So then, quite clearly, from the beginning, this goes all the way back to the people who wrote the Constitution, who signed the Constitution, who authored the Declaration of Independence, they were all still alive. If this were not a true statement, do you think they would have raised a ruckus? Absolutely they would have. Obviously, to anybody who knows history, you can see that America was not founded as a Christian nation. Did it have the majority of its members, its citizens, were Christians? Yes. That still doesn't make it a Christian nation legally. I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus doing what? Building a wall of separation between church and state. Yes, this did not appear in the Constitution. This is not the wording, the exact wording. Separation of church and state does not appear in the Constitution. That's the big argument. It's not in the Constitution, therefore it's not true. But who said this? Thomas Jefferson. Who was Thomas Jefferson? Did he have anything to do with the writing of the Constitution? So when he says this, we can take this as a commentary of the meaning of the Constitution, right? He is telling the Danbury Baptist Church Association that when they wrote the Constitution, when they authored that First Amendment, although Jefferson was not a part of it because he was in France, he wasn't over here either. He still was very much a part of it. They didn't get the Constitution written overnight. It took them months. And during those months, he was sending stuff from where he was over to Madison, who was the principal author. So for Jefferson to say that, and he's using this in the context of that First Amendment, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state, Jefferson is saying this is what we intended when we wrote that Constitution and when we put that First Amendment in place. We intended that there would be a separation between church and state. This is the whole of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition government for redress of grievances. Those are those first five things that we pointed out. So long as the First Amendment is in place and has power our founding fathers intended for it to have, then this nation will remain a free nation. No person or group or entity can force an individual to worship in a manner that is contrary to your conscience. So long as this amendment remains in place, we can speak freely about our religious beliefs to one another. We can assemble for worship on any day that we choose. That's the key point. We can do this without fear of persecution, imprisonment, fines, or the death penalty. But this First Amendment is being picked apart in all five aspects on a daily basis through laws that are trying to be passed and through the court system. We are rapidly losing our First Amendment rights, all of them, not just the right to worship separately as we want to. This deadly wound will not be healed until the old power of persecution is restored. Not until Rome again has the power to make her will and doctrines effective through cooperating legislative enactments. Notice the phrase, cooperating legislative enactments. Legislative enactments being those things that come from our elected officials, right? So be careful who you put in office. You better know who you vote for and that they're going to go up and they're going to protect your First Amendment rights. And not judicial decrees, which means that even the laws that are passed are going to be interpreted by the judiciary. So the judges that sit on the bench, we don't have control over the federal and the Supreme Court judges. We only have control sometimes over local judges, and they don't have any real control over this kind of thing. Whatever passes on the local level is going to get bumped onto the federal level, and the federal judge is not under our control. So we need to be careful who gets put in these offices. But when laws are passed through legislative enactments and judges decree against these established laws, such as the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which I said is under constant attack, these things protect religious freedom for all persons. When these are done away with, then you can be sure that the deadly wound has been healed. When that happens, and it will, it's not an if, it will. The only equivocation here is when, not if. The prophecy of Revelation is about to be completely fulfilled when this happens. So keep your eyes open. When restoration of the power to heal, to deal with heretics does take place, when the deadly wound is really healed, The prophetic time of the end will be near its close, and the climax of the ages will follow. When we get to chapter 17, we'll study more about the healing of the deadly wound, when we learn how the woman rides the beast, because that's what we're talking about. When the woman, the church, rides the beast, which is the government, the civil government, when that stat is reestablished, the Lord's coming is very near. He won't tolerate that. It is impossible right now, impossible as it might seem right now, one day soon, our nation will repudiate every principle of the Constitution as a Protestant and Republican government, and shall make provision for the propagation of papal falsehoods and delusions. We don't think so right now, but it will happen. This is taking place right now when good Christian people are clamoring for the establishment of this nation as one nation under God. They're good Christian people. They just don't realize what they're doing. They don't realize that they're working to establish this nation as one nation under God will destroy the First Amendment principles of religious freedom. We're living in serious times. The end is near. I don't want to be somebody standing on the street corner with a sign, "The end is near," but it's true. I don't know. I mean, this is when we get out and teach people, the only way that we can reach them is with history. We have to be able to go to the prophecy and say, but this prophecy states, and then give them briefly history so that they can have something to think about. And that's what I want to bring out next time on this Daniel chapter 11. A week ago, I was sent a document that was very interesting, and I have permission to share it. So I didn't get the printer. Was misbehaving. Something reset the printer. My machine wouldn't print last night, so Leslie had to get up this morning and print off my documents, but I didn't get a chance to print that off. But it is by an Adventist. The document is by an Adventist pastor. I think he's in California or Oregon, somewhere out there. Anyway, he sent it to me. And I have only briefly done a study on Daniel chapter 11. I've taught it, but I didn't get into it like this guy did. And, you know, you're kind of a skeptic when somebody sends you something and you say, well, I don't know. I mean, how did it come to this? You know, well, when I read through the document, I thought, I don't know. This is pretty good, you know, because he went to history. And everybody knows what Daniel and Revelation, Uriah Smith's book, Daniel and Revelation. You probably all have a copy of it on your shelf, right? This guy discovered that the original, and I have the copy of the original on my shelf that was written in 1881, the original version of Uriah Smith's book had more than 2,200 words describing the events of Daniel 11, 30, 31 to 45. That was changed when the editors got a hold of it in 1944. And the version that you have on your shelf is probably a version of 1944. And they took all that out. There's only 156 words left. From more than 2,200, they whittled it down to 156. So when I found that out from this document that the guy sent me, I thought, well, I got that copy, you know, the older version on my shelf. I'm going to go get it. Well, I have been looking at Uriah Smith for some of the history, but I was looking at it for Revelation study. I wasn't tying in the Daniel part of it. But it fits. What Uriah Smith wrote in 1881 is like reading today's newspaper with what's happening in the Middle East. It's incredible. And I think these things we need to know. It's a brief history. So what I'm going to bring out in the next lesson will just be a brief history of what took place over there after 1798 in the Middle East. So read through that last section of Daniel chapter 11 from about verse 30-31 to verse 45, because that's what we're going to look at next time. And all I'm going to bring you is history. The prophecy that Gabriel gave Daniel in that chapter 11 is amazing in itself because it is such precise history condensed into just a few words. Okay. That's next time, month away. You have a month to get it read and think about it. Chapter 11 of Daniel. Daniel chapter 11, beginning with verse 30-31 and along in there to the end of the chapter.